Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your radio show host, Randy Fine. If mindfulness is the gateway to the awakened life, today's special guest, Stefan Folder's book, What's Beyond Mindfulness, describes the garden that lies beyond, a magical, rich, and fulfilled way of living that comes when we live according to Buddhist practice and principles. This book is a uniquely practical and accessible exploration of Buddhism in everyday life that will appeal to people of any faith and to those of none. It's filled with important concepts such as happiness is found in being, not having. The impact of deep listening and sharing our suffering is a way to build bridges, using mindfulness to heal conflict, and how to make friends with your body, your heart, and mind. Stefan Folder, PhD, is the founder and senior teacher of the Israel Insight Society, the foremost organization in Israel teaching mindfulness and other meditative practices. And he has, over the last 25 years, guided thousands of people in Israel and worldwide in exploring Buddhist teachings, practices, and perspectives. He's also well known for applying these methods to promoting peace in the Middle East. Folder has also written 14 books on health-related subjects. I am proud to introduce and privileged my special guest today, Stefan Folder. Good morning.
Hey, it's wonderful to be here with you. You hit the nail on the head about the book, and also about the possibilities in Buddhist-inspired practice. It brings us into the garden. We can get stuck with mindfulness because everyone's talking about it. And people think, well, if I practice mindfulness, I'll obviously be happy. But we need to go a lot further than that. And so the book itself and also my teaching is about, I would say, an awakened point of view. How a point of view which is about us and the world and us and others and us and ourselves. And if you're in healing, us and our body, that view can make a radical difference in our life in so many different ways. So the book is really about applying a deeper view to daily life situations such as conflict, as you said, or healing, sickness, tiredness, anger, ethics, and so on. But then it goes further into practices that will help actually our awakening. And so it goes really all the way. And I think this is the literature of today. We need to go to the next stage beyond mindfulness.
So when you talk about awakening, what are you describing?
So usually we are kind of behaving, thinking, and doing on a kind of automatic pilot. We're kind of functioning. And there's a lot of shutting down that happens where we don't really see. For example, you go to the shop, you go to the supermarket, and you have no idea when you're there at the supermarket how you got there, actually. How many steps you took? How were your feet as you were walking there? What's your soul as you got to this supermarket? What's in the heart? And suddenly, the magic of life can really expand if we kind of open the box of minimal automatic functioning. So awakening is a process. It's not a state. It's more a process. It's a verb, not a noun. When we actually extend the awareness into our total relationship between us and the world. So, for example, do we feel when we're walking in nature, do we feel that the trees and us are singing to each other, are in deep contact? Do we feel merging with the world? And there would be the key to awakening.
Wow, that's so well said. Your book is divided into three sections, and you know it can be read. It doesn't have to be read in order, but the first part of the book is how we act and function wisely in life in the face of challenges. So, would you talk a little bit about what you share in that first chapter of the book, or the first part of the book?
Yeah, completely. Should we say ethics? So we usually have a code of ethics where we function hopefully wisely and kindly according to kind of what's right. But ethics needs an awakened mind, because how do we know what to do in our daily life with endless dilemmas and uncertainties and issues which every day we are faced with dilemmas, ethical dilemmas. So awakening is a source of acting with wisdom and rightness if we understand or if we have a deeper view of ourselves and the world. That's a small example. Money, that's a big story. And yet if we look at money, we see that it's like water. It goes between all of us. It spreads between all of us. It's not a thing that we can really accumulate. We can imagine that we have lots of money or less money, but actually it passes through human society like water. So we can sort of sense, okay, a different view of money will allow me to let go, to be light. Hopefully, you know, we'll find a way to live, but not to turn it into an icon and a status and a heavy thing, but to see how it is a medium of exchange. I'll give you one other example. Making choices in life, it can be really hard for us to know, you know, shall I go this direction, left or right? What's the right? And it can be a marriage, or it can be a study in university, or it can be just a small thing. What do I buy or what do I eat? So all the time there's choices, and sometimes they give us a hard time. And the reason is But we are trying to predict what is unpredictable. We don't know what the future will be. So we're kind of turning it in our mind and trying to work out the best option for ourselves. But actually looking at it more carefully and more deeply with a bit of an awakened view, we notice that when we make decisions, it comes from a deep knowing, a sense of what is really right, a sense of rightness, a sense of this is right and this is not. I'm not going here. It's clear. And something kind of expresses itself immediately and deeply if our mind is awake and present with all the choices that we have to make in life. So here's two or three examples.
So there is there a right and wrong, or is it really individual to each person?
Well, I prefer the word rightness. It's actually
okay.
More, in a way, the Buddhist teaching would talk about what is wholesome, what is healthy in the soul. I mean, don't mean just the body. What is harmonious, what reduces suffering and doesn't cause more suffering in the world. And all of those lead to a sense of rightness. This is rightness. But the Buddhist teaching doesn't have a kind of category, this right, this wrong. It doesn't go there. And as I say, it needs quite a lot of wisdom to feel what is harmonious. When you meet somebody in the street and someone is annoying you, for example, and challenging you, there may be a place where you say, okay, I won't be reactive and aggressive or defensive. I'm going to look at this person and see where they come from. And from there, I hope the wise and right solution will come and something different, not just automatic reactivity. It's just an example. So rightness rather than right or wrong.
Okay. Okay. That makes it a whole lot clearer. But rightness is based on, so there's no universal rule for rightness. It's really just what feels appropriate to us, right? Or is there a universal rule, law of rightness?
Yeah, I understand. I think there are guidelines. For example, rightness is not causing more suffering to others, to the world, to yourself. Rightness would say, here is a guideline. Or rightness would be, like when you grow up a child and you look after the child, you want the child to be lively, healthy, vital, and kind. And so your rightness will be there in the parental care. And so there are guidelines, and kindness, I think, is a sort of fundamental guideline. But it's not quite a rule of what kindness is in each situation. There's like 10 rules about kindness. It isn't quite like that. But if you keep kindness as a theme in your life, it makes a major change. For example, if you get up in the morning with kindness, you will find that kindness is returned to you. Other people will smile back at you. You will smile at them. You will look at them in the eyes. And you'll find that the guy in the bus or the taxi or the shop, he will or she will give you back your kindness. So and if you say, get up in the morning with anger and reactivity and depression and so on, you're liable to sort of see life like that, and life is liable to kind of turn it, give it back to you. So it's there are guidelines, I would say, yes.
Okay, that explains it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That does. That make a lot, makes a lot of sense. So the second, I don't know if you wanted to talk a little more about that part, but the second part of your book deals with the pathway up the mountain and what we should take with us. So what do you mean the pathway up the mountain? What is that pathway?
Yeah, it's a very nice image. So the pathway is basically practices and attitudes in which you're interested and curious about what's actually happening in your experience. I would say the Buddha, and by the way, the book isn't super Buddhist. We're talking about secular Buddhist teaching fitting the Western culture. It's not a Buddhist book, but it's inspired, of course, by the Buddhist teaching, because I do think that the Buddhist teaching is, on this planet, one of the most sophisticated and beautiful and enormous kind of resources for insight and wisdom and transformation. So I have to say that that's my view. But so the attitude of curiosity, awareness, I am going to undo the box, which is my experience, and see what's in the heart of it. Because the Buddha said, you don't need to look somewhere else, beyond the beyond, behind the clouds. You don't have to go off to the Himalayas. You don't have to kind of hunt for somewhere else that's better. The real liberation is in the very heart of your experience, because right in the heart of your experience is a place which is very pure and very complete and perfect. So, for example, you're reacting in speech to a difficult situation. If you go into that experience, you see what it is pressing your buttons making you upset. You see how you're touched. You see what's coming up from underneath. You might feel your anger, but then you see that it goes and it disappears. And the whole thing is kind of refined to becoming some space, much more spacious. So all that anger and the reactivity, when really seen, becomes spacious, quiet, and you don't need to invest in it. So, it's, of course, this is not instant, but here's an example. Calmness is a quality. So, yes, meditation is really helpful, taking 45 minutes every day or half an hour in the morning to really calm the body, mind, and settle everything down is great. It's a wonderful way to start the day. Mindfulness, of course, is a key, because it's awareness of what's really happening in our body and our mind. Kindness is part of the process as well, that we need on the way to climbing the mountain. Otherwise, we'll be against ourselves and we'll give up and we'll think it's too difficult. We need the kindness. We need the love for ourselves and for others. And basically, steadily, without pressure for being heroic, we climb the mountain step by step by being aware of what's happening step by step. And as we do that, opening the view to look and see what's there at the top of the mountain, what's there, what are the little flowers that are growing on the side of the path. It's not all hard work and technique. It's actually a way of realization, I could say, of really what is our experience at this moment, and there's perfection in that.
So Buddhism is, it's not, I think many people think it's a religion, but it's more of a way of living, right? Is that correct?
Yes, it is. It's a way of life. It's also a lot, a very rich basket of techniques and methods and practices. It's a view. I'm now just launching a bunch of courses online, and I'm calling them the view, because the Buddhist teaching brings us to a view of reality, instead of closing down the doors and sort of withdrawing into our prison or our nest or our fears or our screens or our mobile phones, whatever. Instead of all that withdrawal, it's about connection. And so that connection needs a kind of view. We have to see that we are connected. We're connected with each other. We're connected with the planet. We're connected with the sky above and earth beneath. Our body is made of the water of the seas and of the rain. Every bit of food we eat has been grown in the earth and water and sun, fueled by the sun. And so we're actually fully into being, you call it, connected. And that's kind of a key aspect of view. And it makes our life really happy. Instead of being disconnected, shut down, you know, and withdrawn, it makes our life happy, this view.
Right. It's well, there's that old expression, go with the flow. It's about just easing your way through life, feeling connected. Do we have to be ready to receive these teachings in order for them to help us?
Well, we have to be ready in some way. We have to be basically interested in them. I think there needs to be a little bit of interest. You know, the companies in the companies in the world where the kind of managers are saying, you all need to practice mindfulness for half an hour every couple of days, so that the bottom line is better, so that the company is more successful. And it's a bit of a shame when it goes into that place. So we need to be interested, I think, in the teachings, but it doesn't need us to be already spiritual, already... people can go basically for two big areas will drive people to spiritual life. One is suffering. If they really suffer in their life, and life is really, you know, unexpected and problematic, there is a point, the Buddha said, suffering goes to search or to misery. So let suffering be your teacher, because just like the Buddha himself, or in the biblical book of Job, suffering was the teacher and led both the Buddha and the biblical book of Job, Job himself, on a long search for meaning. What's the meaning of this suffering? And that is one very powerful way that all through the ages people have gone on the spiritual journey. The other source is curiosity. What's the meaning of life? Is there meaning? How do I know meaning? And there's a lot of young people. I've been going around Israel the last couple of years to 30 bars and pubs, and under the title Buddha at the Bar, and talking to young people all over the country with basically packed houses, because there's a loss of meaning. And I don't think it's just Israel. Young people are growing up with a loss of meaning. So here is a place where I think the teachings really have a role to kind of explore, bring back meaning into life. And that's a very powerful resource.
Yeah, I agree. That is powerful. I think, yes, young people are, well, many are distracted, but there are also, not the young people, but there are many people who have become seekers of this kind of knowledge so much more than ever. And I see it on my show. I see it because of so many people that connect with me through their books and teachings, that and so many people listening and wanting to soak up this kind of knowledge. So have you seen this, you know, surge of seekers coming into the world?
Yes, of course, yes, yeah. Completely. You know, I'm one of the pioneers in a way, because I first met the Eastern spiritual teaching in 1976 when I went to India for a year to teach at Banaras Hindu University as an academic. So that was 76. And then from then I kind of brought back the teaching, and I began to see there's so many people who've been making contact with the teachings in a very practical way, not just theoretical, but really practical, and bringing it back to the West. And I mean, the West really needs it. We're basically in crisis, I think, in the Western world. It's not just a crisis of meaning. It's a crisis on many different levels. It's almost like a crisis of civilization. And we really, really need something else that is not just the usual stuff of money and shopping and politics and conflict and pressure and stress. And the Buddhist teaching does come with something really different, something from elsewhere. You know, the solutions always come from elsewhere. We can't always pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. We really need to look elsewhere for solutions to the major problems of our life. And I think the Buddhist teaching is coming at the perfect time, and it's millions and millions of people all over the world are now busy with it and engaged with it, and not just mindfulness. I think there's an understanding, like with my book, that mindfulness is great as a beginning step, but you need to go further.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. What is it that we lose? Because, you know, we have this magic and mystery when we're children, and our imagination is just so open. What is it that causes us to lose that? That feeling, that openness, that magic and mystery of life?
So I think it's basically conditioning. We learn how to function. We learn, the society tells us what to do. We need to get jobs. We need to make money. We need to run a family. There's a certain track, and that involves quite a lot of shutdown. So the magic kind of vanishes, and there's like 20 years education in school, and lots of pressure to be a certain person and have a certain identity. There's pressure to be successful and not failure. There's pressure to be liked and not to be not liked. There's so much pressure, and I think that that basically shuts down the magic, because the magic is without pressure. It's the way, like you're saying, that the small flowers by the side of the path and the breath in your body. So it's basically the conditioning. However, it's never completely lost, because we do have it inside us. And I was very interested to see the other day, for example, a program on mindfulness in schools in California. And it was a film, actually. And I noticed how not so difficult for young people who were youth, were beginning to touch the magic inside themselves by lying down for 20 minutes, exploring their imagination, exploring mindful awareness, meeting themselves again instead of running away from themselves or running off into pressure. And it's there. We didn't lose it completely, but it gets quite squeezed. And we need to be aware of that and be sympathetic to us and say, I don't agree. I'm not going to put up with that. You know the story about the emperor's new clothes, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so we need to be the boy, you know, that sees that the emperor doesn't have any clothes and be honest and say, wait a minute, everyone's agreeing that the emperor has clothes. I don't agree. I see things differently. I can stand up and say, I see things differently, and I think we need that courage to do that.
We need a lot of courage to do that, and I work with people who have been abused by personality disordered individuals, and one of the things that surprises me is that when I, you know, because healing is really about regaining the self again and reclaiming it, and reclaiming it in a much better way than ever. And I often give people permission to be who they are, and that comes as such a surprise to many people, that there are no shoulds in who they have to be. And so that amazes me. But just saying it often releases them from that pressure of, you know, conforming. So it really is deeply programmed into us until we wake up and we realize there is no real way to be. We be who we are.
we express
ourselves the way we do, you know, and that's where, you know, the school system loses children, I believe, because not loses them, but they don't speak to all the children because they're trying to make everybody the same, and we're not. We don't all learn the same.
That's right. So one of the qualities that are very, very strong in the Buddhist practice is the quality of trust. And trust is exactly what you say. It's trusting ourselves to be who we are. That needs trust. If we are on a kind of a track where we have to change ourselves all the time, we're not happy with who we are, we need to fix ourselves, we need to constantly fix ourselves, then there is a lack of trust. We need to trust ourselves. Yes, I am like I am right now. Okay, there is pain. Okay, there has been abuse. There has been a really painful experience in my history. Okay, we're not denying anything, but we can look at it differently and say, trust ourselves to be who we are, allowing ourselves to be who we are. Interestingly enough, at just before the Buddha died, he gave a small talk, which was entitled, Be an Island to Yourself. And he was basically summarizing a lot of practice in the last few sentences of his life. And the question is why he chose that sentence as a kind of summary of his teaching. And I think that it's because it's really powerful that we are standing on our ground, and that we are standing on our ground in this life. And if we stand on our ground, we can change. But if we're all the time wobbling and trying to be somebody else and not as happy with who we are and needing ourselves to be fixed, we miss something very basic. So I like that image. Be an island, and then go out in your life and make change.
Yes, yeah, we are all individuals, and no two people are alike. And you know, when we go through certain stages of our younger life where it's really important to be like everyone, but it's not really who we are, and that can comfort, you know, conforming can be very uncomfortable and painful. So the third, I want to get to the third part of your book, how to look up there and deal with the from up there and deal from the top of the mountain and deal with the divine autonomy, wise social action, karma, and liberation. Okay, so what are you talking about in that section of the book?
Yeah, that goes really all the way. It is the big view. So it's about awakening, and it's about equanimity, and how the practice, when it's developed and refined, brings us to a place of calm awareness and equanimity, where we are allowing things to be the way they are, and we're not knocked over by circumstances that we can't control. We don't take things that happen to us so they don't dominate our inner life. It's not that we become kind of zombies. You know, the Dalai Lama will cry and laugh, and I will cry and laugh, and there'll be emotions and so on. That's not the opposite of awakening. But they don't stick, and they don't last, and they don't turn into a whole story. So we leave the stories and the narratives, experience life in the moment as it arises and as it passes, and a sense of deep freedom there. So many aspects of this are talked about in the last part of the book. For example, karma, which is quite a difficult subject, and lots of people misunderstand it. But looking at it just as a big sense of the whole network or the web of interaction, which actually creates this moment that we experience. This moment that, you know, you, Randy, and Stephen are sitting together, by the way, thousands of miles apart, but there's something holding us together, and karma has done it. And so it's a sense of the big picture is an aspect of that. Another aspect is how we go out and make change in the world. And this is not so easy to understand. And it's more the direction of how to apply wisdom and presence, and you would say nowness, being in the now, and kindness that fuels our actions in the world. And for example, I've worked for years and years with the Palestinians and Israelis, and also with organizations trying to help them deal with conflict inside organizations, using the Buddhist-inspired teachings. And a few keys. One, enduring kindness. So when Israeli and Palestinians sit together, the first thing is make sure there's basic kindness between the two of you, that you're not fundamentally against each other. There may be fear, but you're basically kind to each other because you're looking at each other in the eyes. Secondly, deep listening to each person's life. How is your life? How is your experience? What's your suffering? I want to know, and I'm with you in that. And the third aspect would be just basic confidence and relaxation and ease. So people who have a lot of history can kind of a little bit relax and then allow those other tools to work. So it's these kind of tools are, in a way, they do need a deeper view of what is action. And that's another example of what's in the second, the last part of the book.
Okay, good, thanks. Wow, what a different kind of world we would live in if everyone practiced kindness instead of anger and resentment and all those kind of things, which we see all the time in people. It's such a shame, it really is, that they have to live and bottled up with all that frustration and anger. But anyway, we are coming to the close of the show. So your book, Waking Up to This Precious Life, this is something that we can purchase through online, through Amazon and other places. Where can we get this book?
Of course, of course. The full title is What's Beyond Mindfulness, Waking Up to This Precious Life.
Perfect.
And
thank you.
Yes, it can be. Yeah, and it can be bought through Amazon, of course. It's also, if anyone wants to open my website, stephenfulder.com, the book can, you know, all the information is there also, plus the information on the courses, online courses that I'm teaching. And in a few days, I'm on my way to the States, and I'm doing a tour all over California and West Coast, Washington, New York, for 3 or 4 weeks. I'm going to be
giving
talks for many. Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
and I
you're
think
coming
the,
to
the,
us.
I am, yes, yes. And the itinerary is, it will be there also on my website, anyone that's interested. Happily, they can join. So absolutely welcome.
Okay, and what is your website again?
Stephen Fulder. It's stephenfulder.com.
Okay, perfect. And you know, I didn't know whether you went by Stephen or Stephen, because it goes either way. And I was going to ask you that question, but so you go more.
Yeah,
you go by
okay.
Stephen. You go by Stephen.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
That's
okay.
Right.
All right. Okay. Okay. Well, I so appreciate, and so do my listeners, you calling in all the way from Israel. I know it's quite a difference in time and everything, and it's an effort to call here. So I really thank you for making that effort. I'm glad we were able to make this happen and bring you here. And thank you so much for all that you do for the world and what you've offered us today. I appreciate that so much.
Yeah, thank you, Andy. And I have to say that your mission in life of healing is actually on all levels of a human being. It's the body, it's the emotions, it's the mind, it's the heart, and it's the soul. We need to heal on all those levels. And so I really appreciate your mission as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you. You know that it's what we're here to do. It's not even a choice for me, and I know it's not a choice for you. It's what we do. It's just who
absolutely.
We are.
Absolutely.
So
exactly.
Thank you, and wish you a beautiful evening. I know you said you're having a beautiful sunset, so have a beautiful evening, and welcome to the States when you come. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay.
All righty.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now. Bye.
So we are out of time for today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randygfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.